Auhea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. I nao I mai, I maliu mai, I lohe I a kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh, give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 2075, State of Hawaii versus Yamashita. Arguing for the petitioner, Benjamin E. Lowenthal, Deputy Public Defender. Arguing for the respondent, Richard B. Rost, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning and aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During our hearing, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'd like to start today by asking our attorneys to introduce themselves and the order in which they'll be arguing.
Good morning. Ben Lowenthal, Deputy Public Defender on behalf of the petitioner Joshua Yamashita.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Richard B. Ross for Respondent, State of Hawaii.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ross. Just to confirm, Mr. Lowenthal, you have asked to reserve 20 minutes for rebuttal. So when we get 10 minutes into your initial argument, we'll give you a tone and a light just to alert you that you're at that point. Mr. Ross, you've asked for a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. So we give that you that as well. And then for both of you, when we get to the 30-minute point of your argument, you'll also hear a warning to let you know you're at the end of your allotted 30 minutes. Please proceed, Mr. Lowenthal.
Thank you, and may it please the court. This case puts into sharp focus what our judges are required to do at every sentencing across the state of Hawaii. In every courtroom, every case, for every offense, from murder all the way down to the simple possession of marijuana or trespass, a judge must assess the defendant's ability to pay. And if they can, the judge must order that defendant to fund government services and programs. It doesn't matter if it's a conviction or a deferral. It doesn't matter if there are victims or no victims. It doesn't even matter if there's a criminal fine or restitution on top of it. The judge is required to determine if the defendant is exempt from payment of this, what I'm going to refer to as an exaction or charge, and determine the actual amount and then the rate of payment. In short, the judge becomes a tax assessor and collector all at once. And Joshua Yamashita's appeal is an extreme example that highlights these type of exactions. He has been ordered to pay thousands of dollars that he does not have, and a fine, and is sentenced to prison. And he must fund a government agency that did not intervene in any of his cases. There are two issues here. First is the ICA's failure to look at the uncontested and unrefuted evidence of Mr. Yamashita's poverty. And it is not reasonably foreseeable that he would, to quote the statute of the crime victim compensation fee, as they call it, to quote that language, he will not be able to contribute the $2,075 to the crime victim compensation fund on top of restitution and the actual criminal fine. The second question is a broader question. It's a constitutional one pertaining to the separation of powers and whether this type of exaction that is tacked on at a sentencing hearing is a lawful delegation of the legislature's taxation power. So the first issue, it really calls upon this court to look at zero in on the language of HRS 35162.6A. Court must make the determination if the defendant, quote, is or will be able to pay. State versus Pulgados, the published opinion by the ICA that came out around the time of this case, is exemplary. They look at all of the circumstances, and what the ICA does in Pulgados, we are asking this court to do here, at least for the first issue. When we look at this language of will be able to pay, we believe that that is a signal to the sentencing court to determine what is reasonably foreseeable. And they do that pretty well in Pulgados by talking about possible job prospects, his injuries, and that sort of thing. That didn't happen here. And it's not reasonably foreseeable that Mr. Yamashita is going to be able to pay this fee, or this charge, I should say, of $2,000 on top of the $8,700 in restitution, on top of the child support he testified to. And we don't even know when he's going to be released from imprisonment.
Mr. Lowenthal, what was the amount that the judge ordered?
The total amount?
No, the amount of the CVC.
The CVC amount is $2,075.
And what was the rate at which the judge ordered that he pay?
While imprisoned, it's at a percentage. I believe it's 30%. And then I think that's the rate. It's at a percentage of his income.
And then after prison, was there something about $30 a month?
Yes, it is after prison, it's $30 a month. But again, we don't really have these kind of signals. We don't know when Mr. Yamashita would be released on parole.
But the judge looked at his employment history, at his, possessing a GED, this sort of physical condition, and determined that he would be able to make the $30 a month payment. Was that an abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous in your view?
I think that's part of the analysis that needs to happen. The focus that we have is not so much an abuse of discretion, but as an assessment of the language we'll be able to pay. And it's our position that requires a little bit of looking into the future, but it has to be what is reasonable. And so, yes, physical health, the willingness to get a job, those are the things that the court should look at, but it's not necessarily going to resolve the entire question. And I think an important part of it is the total as it relates to other amounts, such as restitution, such as criminal fines.
Justice McKenna has a question, followed by Justice Wilson. Justice McKenna.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Lowenthal, what you just said relates to what my question, and that is, it appears that he was also ordered to pay $8,767.20 in restitution. That would be paid over 30, at the rate of $30 per month. And so according to my calculations, I did this yesterday, that would be, the restitution would be 24 years, payment of 24 years. And also, my understanding, I don't have the statute in front of me, but he's also obligated to child support, from what I understand, of $100 a month of the two daughters. I understand that they are about 10 and 6 now. So he will have to pay child support for at least another 12 years. At if it's $100 a month, I'm assuming at least $50 a month for the $50 for $100 for another 8 years, and at least $50 for another 2 years, 4 years beyond that. So I'm just wondering, did the trial judge factor in his ability to make these payments more than 24 years from now? The CVCC payments more than 24 years? Did the trial judge actually try to figure out what his employment would be, how much he would be earning 24 years from now after he has paid off his restitution, assuming he's able to do so at $30 a month?
No, the trial judge didn't take that and didn't calculate it to the extent that you have, Justice McKenna. The trial judge the court in its conclusions of law basically said, Mr. Yamashita wants a job, he's healthy, and is learning some kind of plumbing skills, but it's unclear based on the evidence whether it's certified or not, and left it at that. Stretching it out and pointing out that you have 24 years just to be done with the restitution before we even begin the crime victim compensation charge really highlights how long this debt at this rate is going to be following Mr. Yamashita around. So So the,
and in terms of, I'm so sorry, I just have a quick follow-up. In terms of your constitutional argument, you are only arguing that this is a tax. You're not arguing that this is an excessive fine. Is that right?
That is correct. That was one of the issues that was raised. It was abandoned on appeal because if you were to zero it in, well, for strategy and tactical reasons. But no, the question before this court is, in my view, a much more less less out there, I should say, because we have a test here in Hawaii, the Madero's test. We're asking to apply that test.
Thank you.
Justice Wilson, followed by Justice Edens. Justice Wilson, your question.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Lowenthal, about the nature of your objection to the fee in this case, in the sense of whether you're objecting that the fee shouldn't be imposed, or as you're discussing now, the fee should have been less. And I guess I'm asking you the question about whether you are taking the position that there should have been no fee imposed. And if that's your view, then I'm interested in what kind of analysis do you think would have been required that wasn't required, or was there enough done? Is it clear from this record that no fee should be imposed where you have an individual with this criteria? You know, he's young and he has a history that was recited by the judge of having done some employment in the past as a roofer. And the judge also mentioned that he has been working within the prison, and I guess was suggesting that this is an indication of a likelihood that he'll be able to pay in the future, albeit, I suppose, really in the future, since he's going to be incarcerated for a while. So, yeah, is it your position that no fee should have been imposed? And if that's the case, should there be further inquiry at this point? Or is the record clear that it's he wouldn't be able to pay in the future?
It's a thank you. There's two sides to it. I guess I should say that this record does allow the court, I think there is sufficient evidence to show Mr. Yamashita's inability to pay this fee or this charge. That's one question. It's based on the record before us. I should also point out some of the things in the pre-sentence report. And I think it's really important here because this court has an opportunity to provide guidance for the trial courts that if they're going to uphold the charge, you know, the pre-sentence report has an entire section on financial ability. And in this case, the financial section of the PSI was one line, basically said he's got no income because he's been incarcerated. He'd been incarcerated since 2018. The PSI also talks about his inability to pay the fees the last time they were imposed because he was on probation at the time of the plea agreement and sentencing. So there's evidence here to show an inability to pay. And I guess my short answer to you, Justice Wilson, is yes, there is enough for this court to adopt a narrow ruling saying that it was incorrect to impose this charge. That does lead to the constitutional question, and it does leave open the drug demand reduction assessment, the DDR, which is, I think in this case, it was only $100. I shouldn't say only, but it was $100. And it does leave open this constitutional question as well. So
well,
I guess the way I would...
Before you get to the constitutional question, then, if you're suggesting that the record is clear in this case and you're describing the approach that judges should take in the future, or is it your understanding that as a matter of law, then the mere fact that a person is working within the institution and the fact that a person has had prior employment and is also able-bodied is not sufficient to establish ability to pay in the future?
I think it's directly related to the amount that the court wishes to impose. In this case, It's $2,000. You had an Internet Crimes Against Children fee, which is not at issue anymore. But if you go back to the time of sentencing, it was $2,000 for the crime victim compensation fee, another $2,000 for the Internet Crimes Against Children fee, criminal fines, and on top of that, the restitution. I think it comes to around $14,000 originally. And so I think there's a direct relationship between ability to pay and the amount that the court wishes to impose. Had the court said, you're going to pay $100 in one count per case, that comes to $700, which is far more reasonable, and waive all the other offenses. That comes to $700. That would, if those were the facts, my position to say that it should all be waived would be much, much harder. But in this case, every single count was, they set the floor of $100 for the felonies, $55 for the misdemeanors, and I think even $35 for some of the petty misdemeanors. So there is a direct relationship between the amount the court wishes to impose and the facts of a person's financial situation.
Mr. Lowenthal, you were breaking up just a little bit there. Let's hope that it, let's hope you hang in there, and we didn't lose your audio at all, a little bit of video. Let's let Justice Edens ask his question. We'll jump in if it is getting hard for the court to understand you in any way. We'll let you know, Mr. Lowenthal. Justice Edens.
Thanks, Steve. Mr. Lowenthal, you have told us that the courts have effectively acted as tax assessors, and you argue that the imposition of the CBC fees are an unconstitutional delegation of the legislature's taxation power. And I see in your brief where you quote Baker versus Carr, the venerable Justice Brennan's case for the separation of powers or a delicate exercise in constitutional interpretation. You know, we have an amicus in this case. We have the state's briefs, your briefs. In none of these briefs do I see a 1990 Supreme Court case quoted. That's the Muniz-Flores case by Justice Marshall. And in that case, there were two federal misdemeanor crimes in which a defendant was ordered to pay a monetary special assessment to the Crime Victims Fund, which was established in the 1984 Victims of Crime Act. And that was to compensate and assist crime victims, much as the CBC fines here or fees here are due. And what Justice Marshall stated that in response to the argument, there was the argument that it was unconstitutional based on the origination clause of the Constitution. And what that clause stated was that, you know, all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives. That's, you know, in the Constitution. What Justice Marshall said was, one, it wasn't a political question, it was justiciable. And more importantly, for our purposes, what the court did say was that a special assessment statute is not a revenue raising bill within the meaning of the origination clause. So in other words, it was not passed in violation of the origination clause. And what I'm wondering is, why doesn't Muniz-Flores foreclose your argument that the CBC and the DDR assessments are taxes?
The origination clause, as I understand it, is unique to the federal constitution. The question before this court is a separation of powers question under the Hawaii Constitution. And the taxation power is vested in the legislature. And although it doesn't say it in the actual language of the clause, the title under which we find this clause in the Constitution describes it as inalienable. And so since 1911 with the McCandless case up until Medeiros, Hawaii Insurers Council, and now this case, it's been pretty clear for Hawaii constitutional law that the delegate, that the taxation power cannot be delegated. And so it's a little different than the federal constitution's origination clause, because again, that would be a political question as far as where these bills come from. But what we have here is much more of a separation of powers question, which is why I cited Baker versus Carr. And I do believe it is a delicate balance. But one of the things that was attached in our opening brief is a report from the Crime Victim Compensation Commission to the legislature, which in my view, and our view of the defense's view, highlights the distortion that has happened here. The separation of powers is that balance to make sure that the legislative prerogative is with the legislature. When it's delegated to the sentencing courts to fund an executive agency, the executive agency, well, in this report, is going back to the legislature and saying the sentencing courts aren't raising enough revenue. And I submit that in the brief because I think that is pretty clear of what happens when the balance is off or when it is distorted. So my short answer for you, Justice Edens, is this is focused as a separation of powers problem more so than, say, in origination, or more so than that line of cases. I am familiar with the line of cases you are describing.
Let me ask you this. It seems like when I look at 351, and that's the 351.1 is where it really starts, really, on the compensation fund fee. It seems like the legislature has authorized the imposition of CVC fees as punishment. And the reason why I think that conclusion seems logical is when you look at 351.62.6b and the amount, when they're determining the amount of the compensation fee, when you look at that criteria, it talks about the seriousness of the offense, the circumstances of the commission of the offense, the economic aim, the number of victims. And to me, that does seem tied to punishment. What would be what's your response to what seems like a legislative intent that this is punishment, not a tax?
The legislative intent for this statute is kind of a 50-50 on this, because I agree, you do have factors to guide the court to determine the amount. But at the same time, it sets a floor. And so you could have a situation for a felony, say an unauthorized control of a propelled vehicle, that a vehicle is returned. It is pretty innocuous, let's say, under these facts. You could go through all of the factors and conclude this person does not need to be punished. Therefore, normally a fine wouldn't be given, but the floor is $105. And so even though you have all of those factors, it still sets this floor of $105. And I say also the legislative intent also says that the fee was created expressly to prevent the Crime Victim Compensation Commission from appropriating money from the general fund, which is raised through taxes. And so the legislative intent, in my view, cuts both ways.
Justice McKenna has a question. Justice McKenna.
So I do want you to expand on your arguments on the issue of why this would be an unconstitutional tax. You do concede that Medeiros does appear to be distinguishable because even if this is a tax, in Medeiros, the issue was that the legislature had not authorized the county to impose the fee. And in this case, the legislature has authorized the courts to impose specific fees or taxes if they are taxes under Medeiros. So why would this otherwise be unconstitutional?
I think the distinguishing factor is not that it originated from a county ordinance like it does in Medeiros. The legislature can still promulgate a statute that unlawfully delegates its power, not unlike a situation if the legislature were to delegate its lawmaking power.
The fee is actually set by the type of case, right? In terms of the level of the offense, and all the court did here was add up those amounts.
As I understand it, the statute sets a range from $105 to $505. It sets a range and provides all of this discretion to the sentencing court. And I should say, in preparing for this, I looked at the income tax statutes. They read like formula. If you make this amount, it is this percentage. There's no discretion.
In this case, did the circuit court impose the lowest amount or somewhere above the lowest amount?
The circuit court imposed the lowest amount for every offense.
No, please finish. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I would just say that points out, even if the court didn't want to impose it, but determined that the defendant is able to pay, this would be the same amount.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand exactly what you believe is problematic, Mr. Lowenthal. In other words, I heard you talk about discretion as being problematic, although discretion, it would seem, you know, is trying to serve the interests of finding an appropriate level of punishment. And as Justice Edens pointed out, that does seem to be, you know, clearly the statute explicitly talks about reference to sentencing factors and the nature of the offense, and then seems to provide discretion. Is it the element of discretion that's problematic to you, or what exactly is it?
That is a problem, because again, when the legislature passes a law saying we're going to leave it up to the sentencing court to look at all these factors and determine this range, if it is an exaction that is a tax, then in that case, that is the taxation power that is being wrongfully delegated. I guess you could have a situation in which the legislature were to say this is the amount that has to be imposed, and there's still discretion in determining who is exempt and who's not exempt. And that's left to the sentencing court still. So the delegation is happening in two places, determining who's exempt, three actually, who's exempt, how much, and at what rate. These kind of questions are, if it was a tax, are normally left for a legislature in the formulaic statutes that they have.
But that's sort of pushing, in other words, if it were a more formalistic, you know, all defendants shall pay the following amounts, that would be less problematic. Of course, there are other concerns regarding ability to pay that would be due process concerns, presumably.
That is correct. And it ultimately takes us to a place where you can't have a sentencing tax. It does put us in that place. And rightfully so, really, because the sentencing court is not the place to raise money for government services. It is designed to have a fair and neutral sentence. And I know I can see my light is on, and I will get into it in the rebuttal, but I do want to address this this response that these can somehow be fines because of punishment. But they don't share maybe one characteristic of fines in coming up with the amount, but the legislature itself has said this is separate and apart from fines. It is treated for every single type of offense, which right there is a distinguishing factor from the fining power in the Hawaii Penal Code. And the express purpose of this is not to punish. It may be a factor in assessing the amount, but the express purpose is to fund an agency, which puts it in a different category than criminal fines.
Justice McKenna, your question.
So I understand you are actually, it is your position that the ICA erred in trying to distinguish Medeiros and Adcock, and that the Medeiros test actually in this court set out what constitutes a tax, and that this would be a tax pursuant to Medeiros, and Adcock was therefore wrongfully decided. That is your position?
That is correct. Medeiros has been our test for more than 20 years. It's been applied in different contexts, but that is the test we have. And it was error. It's error in that sense that they didn't apply it. And it also puts us in a very strange place. If the Medeiros test doesn't apply, it's creating an additional, are we creating an additional test to determine whether this exaction is a fine before we even apply the Medeiros test? And if so, what is that? It leads us down a very strange place when we start to analyze these kind of exactions that happen at sentencing.
And to make sure I understand your argument, you are arguing that despite the Munoz Flores case of the United States Supreme Court, it is Medeiros that has established what constitutes a tax under the Hawaii Constitution, and this would be a tax under the Hawaii Constitution.
That is correct. It's Medeiros, and I recognize that the Hawaii Insurers Council introduces another test for regulatory agencies, but Hawaii Insurers Council builds off of Medeiros and spends a lot of time talking about what we in Hawaii have referred to as taxes going all the way back to the territorial period.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Lowenthal. We'll move on to Mr. Rost at this time. Reserve your remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to start with the constitutional issue here. And Justice McKenna was just raising the issue of State versus Adcock, where the ICA determined that these types of assessments are really fines. And the state would submit that Adcock was correctly decided. Adcock properly distinguished Medeiros. And we know that because Medeiros is a very specific test. That's what this court said when it considered Medeiros in Hawaii Insurers Council v. Lingle. It said Medeiros is only a test for determining whether or not something is a tax or a user fee. The issue of a fine was not before the court in Medeiros for a very simple reason, and that's because the charge at issue was being imposed by the city and county of Honolulu. The city and county of Honolulu didn't have the authority to impose a fine for a violation of state law. That's clear under Chapter 46. It gives the counties the power to impose fines for violations of the county's law, but not the state's law. So when in Medeiros, this court was looking very closely at Chapter 46-1.5 parens 8. That is the provision that gives the counties the power to charge fees for official services. And that is how the city and county of Honolulu was attempting to justify the fine or the assessment that they implemented in Medeiros. And that provision required Mr. Medeiros to get some sort of actual benefit or service from the charge. And this court, I think, correctly said, well, it's kind of Orwellian to say you're getting the benefit of being prosecuted by the prosecuting attorney's office. So it's not a fee under Chapter 46. And because fines were off the table, the only other option was that it was a tax. But I think even if we look at what Hawaii Insurers Council v. Lingle and Medeiros both say about taxes, we can see that these charges are not what's been termed classic taxation. Medeiros says that the charge there, the monies were going into the general fund of Honolulu. And it said, well, this is general revenue raising since it's going into the general fund, which is the classic realm of taxation. That's not the case here. The drug demand assessment, the crime victims compensation fee, both go to very specific funds that the legislature has set up. So these aren't just going into the general fund, which Medeiros said was a problem. And Hawaii Insurers Council versus Lingle also touches on that issue, because in adopting the test for what a regulatory fee is, it adopts the First Circuit's test from a case called San Juan Cellular. And it quotes San Juan Cellular on what a tax is. And it says, the classic tax is imposed by the legislature upon many or all citizens. It raises money contributed to a general fund and spent for the benefit of the entire community. So again, that's not this. These fees, fines, as Adcock has determined they are, aren't imposed on many or all citizens. They're only imposed on people who commit crimes. And they're not contributed to the general fund. So,
Ross, what's your response to Mr. Lowenthal's argument that the legislature indicated this was intended to relieve the burden on the general fund that would otherwise be imposed if the agency had to be funded from that fund? I believe he referred to that as being an explicit purpose, that, you know, by funding this agency in this manner, it would reduce general fund expenditures. So although not directly going to the general fund, it has a purpose of reducing general fund expenditures. What's your response to that?
Well, I think my response to that is that's true of anything, any charge that's imposed on someone and is designated to a specific purpose. Well, now that specific purpose is no longer going to be funded out of the general fund, but it is being devoted to something very specific, and these are related to crimes. I mean, you're compensating the victims of crimes, you're reducing, attempting to reduce demand for drugs. So those are tied to the criminal conduct that Mr. Yamashita was found guilty of. So, and I think that's something the legislature is allowed to do. It's allowed to say, well, we're going to try to fund these specific purposes by imposing a penalty on the people committing crimes.
Justice Wilson has a question, Mr. Ross.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Ross, let's assume that this is not a tax and that it's a fee imposed for a specific purpose and for purposes of punishment. Well, then let me ask you about Pulgados, because I'm understanding that you feel Pulgados doesn't apply here, but it seems there is a significant similarity between Pulgados and Yamashita in the sense that you have somebody that's got an open term, has been incarcerated for a number of years, has no employment waiting. In this case, you might argue that there's more of an evidence of debt because of the child support payments that need to be made. So in Pulgados, it wasn't enough that he was healthy and it wasn't enough that he would be able to potentially work in the future because he was healthy. And let me ask you then, why is it that Pulgados wouldn't lead us to the conclusion that in this case, there hasn't been a sufficient showing of ability to pay in the future?
Well, I think the most obvious distinguishing factor from Pulgados and what the ICA looked at in its decision here is the circuit court's finding of his employment in prison and that that would give him some better employment prospects upon his release. And that was a finding that wasn't challenged on appeal. So the ICA said, well, that's binding on us. So we're going to accept that finding by the circuit court. So I think that distinguishes Pulgados. I mean, we can get into a granular look at the various factors, his age, his employment history, the fact that Mr. Yamashita has a GED. So, but I think all those things combined, you know, it's an abuse of discretion standard. And I think that the circuit court looked at this pretty closely and it said, well, all right, I'm going to reduce the drug demand assessment to $100. I'm not going to make you pay the Internet Crimes Against Children fee. So, you know, it seems like it was an appropriate use of the circuit court's discretion.
Well, that's helpful because it sounds like you've narrowed the difference to employment in prison. And help me with that. Is the fact that the defendant was employed in prison significant because of the amount he was making? Is it because you contend that he was becoming a plumber? Is it because it shows that he has a willingness to work? Because I don't expect that you mean just because an inmate works in prison that it means that they have the ability to pay when they're released, particularly if the period of incarceration is of a certain length, in this case, 5 years.
Right. I wouldn't say that it's certainly not a situation where you're working in prison, therefore you're going to be able to pay this. But I don't think that's what the circuit court said. I think the circuit court was focusing primarily on his potential employment prospects upon release. And I think that does tie into his willingness to work and gain a skill set.
And that's my difficulty. I'm trying to understand how it would indicate there is a ability to pay in the future because he was being paid in prison for an employment. Because in the past, he worked as a roofer. But that was some time ago. I mean, when he was sentenced, he'd been unemployed for at least, I think, 4 years. So I don't know what it is about him having previously been a roofer. No, as Mr. Lowenthal indicated, the pre-sentence report doesn't seem to indicate that was significant, that he was a roofer before. So I'm still struggling with why it makes a difference that he was working while he was in prison, and that would indicate he was going to have the ability to pay in the future.
Well, I think because the way I read that finding, or I believe it was put in as a conclusion of law, although it's really more a finding of fact by the circuit court, is he's working as a plumber in prison. That's going to give him skills which he will be able to use upon his release to find employment. I think that's how the circuit court framed it. And I that was the finding that wasn't challenged on appeal, which the ICA therefore accepted.
Mr. Ross, a question from Justice Edens, followed by Justice McKenna. Justice Edens.
Mr. Ross, this sort of follows up on what Justice Wilson was just saying. You know, we have an individual who has a drug addiction. He's got 8 separate circuit court cases, criminal cases, 16 plus felony convictions, as well as the misdemeanor petties. He's got no specialized training, a GED. He has to pay $8,700 in restitution, the child support. Those are higher priority payments. He has a very minimal work history. You know, there's talk about roofing work in 2015, where we don't really know what that was all about. And now we're talking about this plumbing skill set, supposedly he has gained from his 25 cents an hour work at Halava. You know, and I understand the courts or the trial court's ruling and your position that in some theoretical future they will be able to pay. But, you know, in your mind, notwithstanding Paul Geddes, is there ever a situation where you could concede that a defendant's not going to be able to pay these type of fees at all?
Well, sure. I mean, I think there's certainly cases where someone, you know, is disabled, is going to be in prison for until they're 70 years old, you know, things like that, where clearly.
So it strikes me that, you know, people who are even less likely than Yamashita are this small category of maybe aged, disabled types. You know, so how can you really square that when the court has to make a decision on whether sometime in the future, despite all these other obligations, despite being a former convict and really not having anything there, as far as, you know, employable skills, much less somebody would hire somebody with that background. You know, can you just explain what type of person who might have gained plumbing experience or any type of employment experience in prison somehow that they can come out and get a job and pay these fees and why that shouldn't be considered seriously by the court when we're looking at ability to pay?
Well, I think it should be considered. I mean, I think it's appropriate for the court to consider the global circumstances that any defendant is in when they're being assessed these fees. And I think that's what the circuit court did. I mean, Mr. Yamashita was, I believe he was 29 years old. So he did have a GED. He was apparently gaining these skills. So I don't think it's unreasonable for the court to say, well, you're probably going to find a job, you know, between when you're released in your probably early 30s and retirement age 30 years from now. I don't think that's an abuse of discretion given what this was before the circuit court, but you know, I'm not saying it's a clear cut issue, and I'm not saying that every person who has an employment in prison is necessarily going to be able to pay the fee, whatever it is. But I do think because the circuit court reduced some of the amounts being assessed and considered those things, it's not an abuse of discretion in this particular case.
Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Mr. Rost, I'm wondering, at some point, does the issue of whether someone will be able to pay something 24 years later, is there some point that 24 years is speculative in and of itself? And the follow-up question is there some mechanism by which if a defendant can move later to set it aside?
I think, you know, well, to address the second part of it, first, I think there is. I think they can. I think a motion for reconsideration based on whatever their circumstances are, and this ties into what I've been arguing in several of these cases. Because, as the court probably knows, Adcock, Pugados, Yamashita, Mr. Lowenthal, and I have been on in all three of those cases. So, the issue here is that the fines don't kick in until after Mr. Yamashita has successfully paid off $8,700 of restitution. If he never pays $8,700 worth of restitution, he never has to come up with the $2,100 approximately in fines. So, I mean, it sort of cuts. It's kind of an interesting situation because, but by saying, well, it's speculative to order him to pay this 24 years in the future, that might say, well, don't let him pay it at such a slow rate. Don't allow him to pay $30 a month. He should have to pay it more quickly. And I think it's Mr. Yamashita's benefit that he's not being ordered to pay it so quickly that he's only required to pay it at, I believe it's 25% of his income in prison and then $30 a month thereafter. So, and I think that's the proper question to look at is he able to pay it as it's been ordered, you know, not can he pay $2,100 tomorrow? It's can he pay it after he successfully paid off $8,700 worth of restitution? And to your question of whether it's speculative, it's not easy, I would agree, for a circuit court to look 24 years into the future and say, well, I think you'll be able to pay it off. But I do think that it's the circuit court can say, well, in 24 years, you'll be in your mid-50s. That'll still be working age. You'll hopefully have put your criminal past in the past and have employment and be able to pay this off.
I'm sorry. Can you educate me on whose burden it is to establish ability to pay or inability to pay?
That's a good question. I think it should be the burden of the defendant to show that he's not able to pay. But the statute is. If we're talking about the crime victim's compensation fee, I don't think it's. It just says it's imposed on whoever is or will be able to pay, and I think it's incumbent on the defendant to say if I can't pay, here's my evidence that I can't pay this.
All right.
Thank you.
Justice Edens, followed by Justice Wilson.
Mr. Ross, you know, you mentioned that the fees, you know, might not ever get paid because the restitution has to come first. And, you know, 351.62.6 subsection C states that the compensation fee shall be considered a civil judgment. So it seems to me that that's just always going to be out there, that it could be enforced at any given time. What's your take on that subsection of the statute?
Well, because the court ordered the restitution to be paid first, even if it's a civil judgment, I don't think it can be enforced until the restitution is taken care of. I don't see how you enforce something, even if it's been reduced to a civil judgment, because the conditions that it was imposed under was you pay restitution first. And yeah, it might be out there, but it's not going to mature or take effect until the restitution is paid.
And let me ask you one follow-up to that. In your experience, yourselves or Department of Attorney General, anybody ever sought to enforce civil judgments on CVC fees?
I have not seen that. I'm unaware of the Attorney General's office doing that. I'm not saying it's never happened, but I'm not familiar with that happening.
All right. Justice Nakayama, followed by Justice Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. In furtherance of Mr. Justice Edens' question, if the compensation fee was considered a civil judgment under 351.62.6C, doesn't that limit the enforcement of it to only 10 years, plus if applied for an extension, another 10 years? So does that mean that the max it can ever be enforced would be 20 years at any rate?
That's an interesting question because it's considered a civil judgment, but we have a criminal judgment that's ordering him to pay. So that's not a question I've looked at, and that could certainly be the case that you could argue that because it's considered a civil judgment, that it only takes effect for 20 years, although... But there's also this criminal judgment.
If there's a criminal judgment, how long is that a liability to the defendant on the criminal judgment?
Well, I don't know that there's a specific limitation, at least not the same one that, I mean, not an obvious 10-year one, like a civil judgment.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Ross, I just wanted to get your specific position with respect to any potential standard that we might clarify with respect to what constitutes ability to pay in the future. There's a line of Oregon cases, the State versus Mejia and State versus Villalta is an example, that makes it clear that ability to pay in the future cannot be determined based on the fact that the defendant is committed to have a job in the future, or that the defendant is able-bodied. And their standard also takes into consideration the length of sentence. So what would be your thoughts about our court having a similar approach?
Well, I think you should take into account able-bodied, because that's relevant, what to someone's ability to find work and to pay. But I think what the circuit court considered here were appropriate factors: work history, education, age. And yeah, I do think, as you say, length of the sentence is something you should probably consider, because someone who's going to prison for 5 years is probably going to be in a much better position than someone who's going to prison for 40 years. So I think all of those factors are appropriately considered by the circuit court.
I don't recall the circuit court considering a length of sentence, but if you're saying just
right, I don't
in
know.
General, that I understand what you mean. Yeah,
in general, yes. I'm not suggesting the circuit court explicitly. I think that's kind of implicit, because the circuit court knew how long it was sending Mr. Yamashita to prison for and considered that he was working in prison. But I don't think the circuit court said I'm explicitly considering the length of the sentence.
Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Ross?
I just would like to touch briefly on a case that I think is informative here, that's been cited by both parties, and that's the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Department of Revenue of Montana versus Kurth Ranch on the constitutional issue. In Kurth Ranch, Montana was had imposed what they called a tax on possession of illegal drugs. And the way it worked was, after someone was convicted of a drug crime and sentenced, the Department of Revenue would come in and try to impose this tax on the value of the illegal drugs this person had. And the U.S. Supreme Court said they couldn't do that, because it was really a fine, not a tax, and therefore it was a violation of double jeopardy to come in after the fact and impose this tax. And I think, and what one of the things the U.S. Supreme Court considered was, this is a quote from Kurth Ranch, "This so-called tax is conditioned on the commission of a crime. That condition is significant of penal and prohibitory intent rather than the gathering of revenue." And that's true of these fines at issue here. They're conditioned on commission of a crime, which the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated, yeah, that's more like a tax. I mean, that's more like a fine than a tax. And I think Kurth Ranch also is kind of a be careful what you wish for type of warning for the argument being made by petitioner here. Because if this is truly a tax, if what the legislature is doing is tax, then if it's not appropriate for the court to be imposing that, then the legislature could simply say, okay, well, we're going to have the Department of Taxation come in after the judgment, and everyone who gets convicted of these will have to pay these as a tax. And there wouldn't be a double jeopardy concern anymore, because it's a tax, not a fine. So, I think it's pretty clear. I think Kurth Ranch is really strong indication that these are fines and that they're appropriately imposed by the court. And that goes into what is a fine versus what is tax. And, you know, this court has said that a fine is a pecuniary punishment or penalty. Okay, that's my 10 minute warning, correct? Five minute warning. Sorry. Yes. Thank you. So when you look at whether this is a pecuniary punishment or a penalty because it's being imposed along with a criminal sentence versus something that's a tax, which this court has said gets imposed on many or all citizens and is used for a general fund, neither of those things apply. When you look at how Medeiros and how Hawaii Insurers Council versus Lingle define taxes, it seems pretty clear cut that this is not a tax in any sort of traditional sense, that it's a fine. So once we get to that point, as we've been discussing, you know, the ability to pay question, I think we've discussed that pretty thoroughly. The one thing I would note, we've mostly been talking about the crime victims compensation assessment, which is the bulk of the amount assessed here. The drug demand reduction assessment, which is only $100, that is different because the statute says if the defendant can't pay, the circuit court may reduce or waive it. So that's pretty clear discretion. It's not required to waive it like with the crime victims compensation fee. And because I think the circuit court appropriately exercised that discretion here because it reduced the amount from $1,000 to $100. And so I don't think that was inappropriate under these circumstances. And I would also point out that the legislature knows how to draft a statute that requires waiving the fee if the defendant can't pay, like the Internet Crimes Against Children fee under Chapter 846F. That says very clearly if you can't pay, it has to be waived. But the drug demand reduction assessment says the circuit court may waive it, and may is discretionary. So I just like to make that distinction.
Question from Justice McKenna. Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Mr. Rost, I'm following up on Justice Nakayama's question with respect to civil judgments. And as she indicated, we do have law saying that civil judgments are effective for 10 years, and then if renewed, can be effective for another 10 years. I'm wondering, and I'm also aware that restitution is treated as a civil judgment, and it appears CVCC is now a civil judgment also. I'm wondering whether it makes sense for courts to order civil judgments that would not be effective after 20 years.
I'm not 100% sure I understand what you're getting at here. I mean, if it's not going to be valid after 20 years, is that a reason not to order it?
In this situation, we do have an order saying that the CVCC would not trigger for another 24 years after the date of the findings of fact. So I'm wondering, you know, at a certain point, should defendants in criminal cases be treated, if the legislature wants these orders to have the effect of a civil judgment, then why should the defendants not also, which burdens them for 20 years, because then they're enforceable as a civil judgment, but why shouldn't they also get the benefit of the civil judgment rule? That basically after 20 years, you get a clean break and you don't have to keep paying this for the rest of your life.
Well, that's a good question. I would say that it makes sense to look at it as an enforcement issue. because like even standard fines, the statute says you can go enforce those as a criminal, as a civil judgment. So that's how pretty much all of these financial charges are treated by the legislature. So does it make sense to say that it expires automatically if it's not, if it's going to expire in 10 years and it can be renewed for another 10? I would have to say it's reasonable to say that maybe you shouldn't have to pay it after 20 years if it's going to be considered a civil judgment. But at the same time, that may encourage the circuit courts to say, well, I'm going to make sure that this gets paid off in 20 years. So I'm going to order you to pay an amount that I think you can pay on a monthly basis and figure out what that is after 20 years. That is one way the courts could approach it.
I have another question. You know, by the same token, I believe we have case law saying that a civil judgment is effective for 10 years, but there are requirements to have it renewed for another 10 years. You have to make an application by a certain date, or you miss the deadline, you're out. So if these are supposed to be treated as civil judgments, then why has there been some mechanism where they're being renewed, or are they actually only effective for 10 years?
I'm not sure what the practice is regarding whether or not someone is coming in to renew these after 10 years. That's a good question. It's something that should be considered, I think. And, you know, that makes sense to you know, say it's good for 10 years if it's not renewed. And if we're going to consider it a civil judgment, you know, it's going to be incumbent on the state to make sure it gets renewed after 10 years to get that extra 10 years of enforceability.
Ross, you've gone over the 30 minutes, but I do want to give you the opportunity to wrap up with any final thoughts for the court today.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I would just say, you know, if you look closely at the ICA's decision in Adcock, they closely considered Medeiros, and I think they got the right decision in determining that these are not unconstitutional taxes. I think in this particular case, the circuit court properly exercised its discretion and assessed an appropriate amount upon Mr. Adcock. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rust. And Mr. Lowenthal, your rebuttal.
Thank you. Just to be absolutely clear, the respondent talks about Kurth Ranch and the Supreme Court case, United States Supreme Court case of Kurth Ranch, talking about incurring financial exactions or charges for the commission on the condition of a crime. One of the biggest cases that stands in the way of purely applying Kurth Ranch is Medeiros itself. Medeiros was conditioned on a conviction. That's what brought the test about in the first place, that this conviction triggered a test to determine whether this was a lawful delegation of power. It's very similar to what we have here. The other thing that's important is that if we are going to say that the crime victim compensation charge is actually a fine, we don't really have a clear picture as to how do we assess what a fine is. And there are really two approaches to it. The court could say a fine is whenever the legislature says it's a fine, in which case it didn't say that. As a matter of fact, it says quite expressly that it is separate and apart from a fine, not only in the CVC statute itself, but also in Chapter 706, when you talk about the disposition of defendants, they distinguish fines from the court fees. That's one approach. The other approach is to look at the purpose, which, you know, we do have a lot of case law going back to Toyomura talking about, and I think it's Gaylord, talking about a fine. A fine is an economic sanction imposed by the court to punish, and I should add, solely punish. I understand that in assessing the amount for this charge, courts can look to factors of the criminal behavior and that make it kind of look like fines. But at the end of the day, the purpose of this charge is not to punish. And that's what we keep saying in our briefs, and is that the This is a rote imposition on every single person who is convicted. And to say that that's not classic taxation, therefore you don't have to apply the test, belies Medeiros. The same could be said for Medeiros, and that's where the test came from.
Mr. Lowenthal, if we could talk about the issue of the amount of the imposition on the defendant or the amount of the fee. Mr. Ross made the point that, you know, the legislature here has directed that future ability to pay is to be considered. In other statutes, it's only present ability to pay. So the legislature has directed that to be the inquiry. What is the test that you think is an appropriate test to apply? What exactly are you advocating for? Because whatever we do, you know, the trial courts are going to have to apply it. What would the guidance be that you suggest should be applied?
Assuming that, and this is for the first issue, assuming that this is a valid charge that can be imposed at sentencing.
Right. Assuming that.
The first step is to determine whether the defendant falls within the ambit of the statute, which is either can they pay now or will they be able to pay in the future? To answer that question, we suggest we need to look at what is reasonably foreseeable. It bleeds into the second provision, which is the amount. And if the amount that the court is contemplating is astronomical, which we suggest in a case like this it is, then that's going to determine the ability to pay. So they do interact with each other. We propose the standard of what is reasonably foreseeable, because that is flexible, that can assess the amount, and it can also take into account whatever the court has in front of it. I did incite cases from other jurisdictions that have confronted similar language that simply adopt that standard. So we would ask that that standard be adopted. I know that Justice McKenna asked a great question about burden, and I would suggest that, you know, when it comes to things like finances, typically, yes, it is on the burden for the defendant to show their own finances. One of the things that was raised in the trial court, I think it was raised here, and forgive me if it wasn't, it might have been in one of the other cases, is if a defendant is represented by the Office of the Public Defender, there should be a presumption of indigency. And that presumption of indigency doesn't change throughout the course of litigation, and it shouldn't change at sentencing either. So I think the burden, yes, it's on the defendant, but at the very least, there is the presumption of indigency for public defender clients.
Justice Nakayama has a question. Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Lowenthal, yes, you did raise that in this case. And I guess one of my questions is, has there ever been an instance where a victim or the prosecution on behalf of the victim comes in to change the rate of pay because the defendant has been able to obtain a better job or better prospects?
I would contemplate a situation like that happening more so with a restitution award, because that money goes directly to a victim. I have not seen it. I'm sorry.
Actually, that you answered my question. So if the person comes in, at, or whatever the victim or the prosecutor comes in and wants to restructure the restitution order to pay more quickly, then the payment of the restitution will thereby shorten. Makes sense, right?
Right.
So then the CVC, it is possible the CVC fee could come within 20 years or be the time that the defendant would have to start paying it would be a lot sooner.
That is possible. I mean, another scenario would be if the defense came across evidence that showed restitution was actually improperly given. I mean, I can speak of cases in which a victim makes a restitution claim, it's awarded, and it turns out the property that they had at issue wasn't correct anyway.
And
so we could have that situation too.
Sure. And in this particular, I meant to say it's possibly fluid. It's not written in stone.
It is possible. Yes.
Okay.
But
your client expressed a willingness to work. I mean, as I read the record, it was like, I'm not just going to sit here. You're putting me in prison. I want a job. And then, and he's working 35 hours a week as a learning and assisting with plumbing. So as well, I think the judge obviously took that into consideration in his future. So it's kind of one of your arguments, by being such a model prisoner, you're kind of punishing him by loading these fees on him after he gets out? Because it does seem like he was home. You say in your briefs that he was homeless before he was picked up on this, and the judge mentioned he had a bad drug addiction. It seems like he's working hard now. He wants to be a plumber. He's learned new skills. Why can't the judge take that into consideration for his future prospects? Are you just saying that she's punishing him for trying to be a better person?
Well, it's a difficult position, I think, on this record. Originally, I should also point out, this was not a prison recommendation. It was a plea agreement in which she wanted to be released to some sort of treatment. So, yes.
Yeah, I understand. It was the judge didn't go with the plea agreement.
Right. I point that out because that's correct. He was very forward thinking. He wanted to take the initiative. He wants to work. But at the same time, and this is why we are advocating a position of what is reasonably foreseeable, because the intention of the defendant is one thing, and it's great. And I can say a lot of defendants want to work. But again, this is a unique situation. And actually, you have a record in which a person who's going to have 16 felony convictions as a plumber might have a very difficult time finding a job, let alone being invited into people's homes. It could lead to all sorts of unforeseeable problems. And so we advocate the reasonably foreseeable standard because it does take into account what you say, the intention, the desire to work, but at the same time, the realities, economic realities that may be out there. I think the standard we are advocating is nuanced enough to incorporate those things.
Justice Wilson has a question. Justice Wilson.
Thank you. So, Mr. Lowenthal, I'm sure you recall that Mr. Ross distinguished the Pogados case based on the fact that there was an employment history arising from the work as a plumber. And you seem to, and correct me if I'm wrong, concede that there could have been a victim compensation fee imposed. It just should have been lesser. So would it be fair to say that in your view, this is different than Pogados, and that there is a basis to award a victim compensation fee because, as Mr. Ross points out, there's a history of employment in prison. The real issue here is just how much should have been imposed, and therefore your remedy is to remand for further calculation of what the appropriate fee is?
That is definitely a possible remedy for this case. I guess I should say it this way. I don't think that the fact that Mr. Yamashita has a better work history than Mr. Pogados is so distinguishing that they can afford the amount that was ordered. The relationship between ability to pay and amount, they're directly connected. And so I guess what I said earlier was that if the court were to say, I'm going to only award one felony fee per case, so it's around $700, $800, as opposed to $2,000 or $2,100, it would make the job prospects a bigger factor. And again, it would be closer to what is reasonably foreseeable. And that's probably the best way I could answer that.
Mr. Lowenthal, if it's 24 years out, how is it different? And I understand. I think I sort of understand you're looking at another aspect of this, which is what is the total amount. But if the question is foreseeability, how does that materially affect foreseeability of what's going to happen in 24 years?
It does. And again, that goes to rate of pay. And I think all of it needs to be assessed together. And, you know, the last page of every pre-sentence report for the judge has a list of the maximum fine, the maximum fees, the maximum everything. They're all to be assessed together. And so perhaps I misspoke, or perhaps I got ahead of myself in thinking about this problem solely from the point of view of one of these charges. But yes, you're absolutely right. We have to look at the restitution award first and then determine whether there's even time left to assess these fees. I guess the hypothetical I was saying is that the fact that he works, if the fee was lowered to another amount, that would change things. If there was no restitution, then that would change things as well. And so I think they all need to be assessed together and make it, that's why it's part of the sentence.
Very well. We're pretty far over on your time, but if there's any final thoughts you have for the court,
please. Yes, thank you. I wanted to summarize that a sentence, when I think about it and when we think about it, it's an act of power, and it has a power derived from the legislature and the Constitution. And this case really does present the question of the independence of the judiciary and what sentencing is for. And when the power to sentence someone is used to raise revenue, then the separation of powers is thrown out of balance. It's distorted. And I think the report from the agency that's attached in my brief really sets it up. From the agency's perspective, sentencing becomes something where they depend on more prosecutions, more offenses, more sentences, and more counts so that they can raise money. And I'll just close by saying that when the sentencing court becomes an avenue to raise money for the agencies, for the government, it advances a governmental financial interest, and it really undermines the neutrality of the court's job. And so this court has an opportunity to apply a test that has been on the books for 20 years to determine whether these charges are truly what they say they are. And so I thank you. Thank you for your time.
Very well. Thank you very much to both of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo kie kie hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.